simultaneously and sustain it. Very difficult. No matter what material you use, it's going to be melted and vaporized at those kind of temperatures, so containing it is very difficult. K2KUI, K2RAW.
Roger. The containment is, I guess, the major problem. Okay. Well, we'll be off to Mars, I'm telling you. Someday we're going to develop these things, and I know my daughter, she listens, and she says, well, every time you say something about, you know, this, she's very involved with loving this space travel, space shuttle, and all this stuff, and of course, she says, you know, a lot of talk when she was going to college was with young people that they hope they would be amongst the first visitors or, you know, or in their lifetime see the trip to Mars and whatnot. So I think that's still on the table, Dick. Okay, well, should I check out some emails here that are a little bit more down to earth, over?
If Mars is a nice thing to dream about, I'm still convinced that you and I will not see it in our lifetime, though, even if you had the energy to get there. The time it takes to get there and the amount of consumption of raw materials of a human body is the problem. For you and I to have enough air, water, and fuel, air, water, and food, for a 3-year mission and pack that on board is a very difficult thing. Huge amounts of recycling is going to have to take place. A lot of development is going to have to take place before we can do that level of recycling of every single molecule of gas, liquid, and solid that comes out of the human being. Every single one of those molecules must be recycled. That's what the Earth does for us, and we take that for granted. And to install all of that machinery in a high reliability manner onto a compact spacecraft and do that for the next 3 years, that is a tough assignment. Over to you, Mel.
Say 3 years. How about a direct flight? I mean, everything is based on now, you know, they're not really anything been sent as direct flight. Is there possibility of breakthrough in some engine technology that's going to permit a direct flight, Dick, over?
WS2N?
Vaguely possible, but the energy increase to go from a 3-year mission, 1 year out, 1 year on the surface, 1 year back. When you go from that 3-year mission to, let me pick a number, a 1-month mission, you might need 1,000 times more energy. And that's tough. But Paul's going to tell us how to do it. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, there's this one guy, he's an astronaut. He's been in space more, I don't know how many thousands of hours he's got up there. Wish I could think of his name. He's done so many space walks. Well, I don't remember, but he's developed an engine. He's working with a company to increase the amount of power using magnets and protons. It's type of engine, not an ion engine, but he wants to shoot heavy atoms out of the back using magnetic fields. He was on not too long ago. He wants to cut the time down instead of a year, 7 months to space now to Mars, but he wants to cut that down to just maybe a month or two to Mars, and then he feels it would be doable. There's also another show on not too recently called Known Universe, and I believe they said 600 refrigerators filled with food would be the amount of food that you would need for a crew of 5, Dick. So to go back to your topic about just the amount of food that you would need. So it's going to be an overwhelming challenge to either develop an engine to cut down the time or to send all this food, water, air, and God knows what else to, fuel and everything else to not only land but to come back. It's an overwhelming task. Many years down the road. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, one of the very rough approximations I've used in the past, Paul, is that the amount of air, water, and food that I consume in 1 year fills up the approximate volume of my house, and it has the mass of approximately my house. So the weight of my house and the volume of my house is what I consume in air, water, and food in 1 year. To pack that on board is tough. Something you just said, okay, with this engine where if you can get enough thrust out of it to get you there sooner, you don't need as much, but still 600 refrigerators. And that's just the that's just the food and water. Does that include all of the oxygen the guy has to consume? You keep track of the progress ships that bring raw materials up to the International Space Station, and I think they get a progress ship giving them replaceable materials roughly once every month just to maintain those two guys on board. Is that roughly the numbers, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Six times a year, and I think it's something like 6,000 pounds of material, and now they have the new one being built by, that has been built by Italy, and that's called the ATV, Automatic Transit Vehicle. They have different names, the Jules Verne, Leonardo da Vinci, they have the different names, you know, and they carry three times the amount of product up to the space station, but they don't go as, only sent a couple up, just two since its inception, and if they have a dozen more to go. The progress ships are invaluable. And, you know, every 2 months, you know, and that's for a crew of three. They want to double a crew. And without the space station, without the shuttle, it's going to be unbelievable. The shuttle used to bring a lot of raw materials up as well. So I don't know, they're going to probably have to have, they'll have to go to once a month, I guess, with the progress ships to back you.
Here's a tough question, Paul. How much backlog do they have? If there was a failure in the Progress launching system, and if for some reason no more shuttles could go up for a while, the consumables they have on board in the warehouse, so to speak, how long would that sustain the astronauts, do you think? How much backlog do you think they've got, Paul? Go ahead.
Their flight rules require 6 months, but who's ever up there? One person or three or six? 6 months capability. Well, that's cutting back on everything. But that's what they need. If they see that it's going to delay longer than that, they have to abandon ship. Back to you, Dick.
And there's always enough Soyuz spacecraft on board to bring everyone back if need be. Is that true?
Yeah, again, flight rules. People, of course, they have enough seats for themselves to return. When they leave six on board, they're going to have to leave two Soyuz ships attached. You'll also notice the first thing that they do when a space shuttle goes up, and there's going to be the first thing that they bring in after shaking hands is the seat of the person that's going to occupy the space station. The seat will be installed into the Soyuz craft, like almost immediately, and the old one ripped out. The seats fit, they are form fitted for each astronaut, and so that's a priority. So this way, if there's an emergency, as they're spending, say, 2 weeks up there, 1 week goes by, emergency, abandoned ship, everybody jumps into the space shuttle, that guy who's got to jump into the Soyuz spacecraft has to have the proper seat to return to Earth. So, yeah, they have all this written into their flight rules. Back to you.
Are you saying that if they had to abandon ship, during the time that the International Space Station is being visited by the space shuttle, that in many times there aren't enough chairs, so to speak, on the shuttle to bring everyone home. That at least one guy has got to go home in a Soyuz. Is that what you're saying?
No, every now and then a space shuttle goes up with a replacement astronaut. You know, they'll have a crew of, say, six, and the seventh guy is going to replace somebody else that's up there. That means one person is coming home, and that person will be coming home on the space shuttle. So that's why they do the seat exchange, pull out the old one from the from the astronaut that's on board the space station, and put the new one in for the new guy that's replacing that astronaut. So that's the way that works. So there's always enough. So if seven goes up, there'll be seven coming back. Might not be the exact seven. It might be six plus the guy that's been up in space for 6 months. And then the Soyuz craft will have the same three seats, but now with the same three people that came up, you know, they'll have the two and then the replacement astronaut that just joined them. For instance, the last flight that went up, they brought the first Japanese guy up. He's staying up there permanently for the next 6 months. So he just went through that whole process. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
From what you've just told me, Paul, the Soyuz can bring three cosmonauts back home, maximum three. Has it ever flown back with two? Back to you, Paul.
Well, they've gone up with two, and they have gone back with two. For instance, after the Columbia accident, they always needed to keep the space station operable. So they had a standard crew of three, but they dropped down to two because of what we talked about before: food, water, resources weren't being brought up on a regular basis by the space shuttle, just by the progress ship. So capability of three on board. They've gone up with two, gone back with two. And then when they resumed the crew of three, they went back to the new system of, let's say they're just going to go up with two and they don't have a planned return of a third person. So they'll bring up another extra person for an extra $20 million. A Dennis Tito type, or Mark Shuttleworth, or a couple of the other people that have paid this $20 million to fly on the Soyuz spacecraft. They have a vacant seat. Why not charge for it? So they'll go up and spend, say, 6 days or 7 days. The last guy was 10 days for a visit to the space station and then return. So that's the way it works. Back to you.
And my last question, Paul, is, to your knowledge, how much has NASA done recycling experiments on the ground, on the shuttle, anywhere? How much recycling of air, oxygen, fluids, or solids has been done to date that you know of? Over to you, Paul.
Recently, they got this urine recycling thing going. That was initially bought up a while back, and then it was not functioning properly. They've got oxygen generator systems that they have problems with, primarily built by the Russians. They've had those problems. They seem to have worked that out. That's not really a recycling, though. Carbon dioxide that gets recycled to some degree, I believe, and I think that's about it. Everything else, water. Well, they bring tons of water up. They bring them up in these big bags, And then any leftover water from the fuel cells from the space shuttle, they leave behind for the crew. So there's not a heck of a lot. You know, if you're getting at growing things in space and things like that, if they've got a handful of vegetables to grow in all these years, that's probably a lot. They got a long way to go, Dick, before they start raising cows up there and having steak from cows that are made in space. Back to you.
Interesting. You did say that the water that comes out of the fuel cells is left. Is the water out of the fuel cells pure enough after filtration? Is it good enough for human consumption?
Yeah, I heard just chill, filter, and drink, you know. And the filter isn't from the water. It's just, you know, maybe any contaminants that might be in the hoses and lines back to you.
Okay, so some recycling there is taking place. This has got a long way to go, though, to do what the Earth does. Because the Earth does recycle every single molecule that ever comes out of or goes into a human being. I've seen the calculations, and the calculations say, with essentially no doubt, every breath you take contains air molecules that were once inside of the lungs of every single human being that has ever walked this earth in the past. Assuming the person lives for a lifetime, I guess. So, in a lifetime, there are enough molecules of air that you breathe that go out back into the atmosphere, get recycled, mixed and whatever. So every breath you and I take has once been inside of another human lung, meaning every single other human being that has ever walked the earth. That's a sobering thought. We're all rebreathing cycles that recycle air. We have no choice. Mel, should we recycle some of our mail? What kind of challenging questions have you gotten this week that we should look at? K2KEY, K2LIW.
It says K2KEY, yeah. I guess that whole situation with, consumables and all. There was an experiment done some years ago, I'll say it was the last few words, that will take one of these pieces of mail. That biosphere experiment, I think, proved out that you can't really recreate, what takes place on the Earth in any form. I think they were testing whether or not something like a biosphere could be practical, I guess, to build something like that in space. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
The experiment was a partial failure, as I see it, Mel. Not because the idea was wrong, but because of the facilities they had at that time were not sufficient. Can you create an environment where, with the sun shining and the water flowing and the right kind of recycling machinery on board or in your biosphere, can you recycle everything and make a self-sustaining system? I know the answer is yes, but I think some further developments are going to be required to make it happen. They thought they were already there, and I think the answer is we're not there yet. That's my understanding of it. Back to you, Paul. Sorry about that, Mel. And by the way, your daughter likes listening to science issues about space in particular, is what I think you're saying. Is that true?
Exactly. I've said it since she was a little girl. We went to space camp. That was something. We went to Huntsville, Alabama. Went to space camp, and we've been down to Florida, down to the Cape, and all that kind of stuff years ago, Dick. So it's always been an interest in there. And, that was, the whole idea. Could you build something like, could you put on the moon eventually an actually self-sustaining civilization? That is what was the question over.
I know the answer is yes. The raw energy that you and I live on comes from the sun. That sunlight is equally as bright or a little bit brighter on the moon. So the raw energy is there. You bring the right recycling equipment with you and the right raw materials with you that you're going to recycle. I know the answer is yes. I didn't say it's easy. I don't say we've got the ability to do it yet. But within the laws of conservation of energy and the way recycling takes place on the Earth, it is my strong belief that that is a realizable goal, and someday I think that goal will be realized. Back to you, Mel.
Like I say, trip to Mars is going to be on again one of these days. And I know, because my daughter, she kept saying to me, she says, oh, she says, when they told Christopher Columbus that he'll never make it or whatever, everybody, she says, always say, she says, shows me articles all the time that there was once, within the last 100 years, there was a prize of so much amount of money for the first person that could fly an airplane from here in Long Island, from Roosevelt Field, or someplace out there, to Albany, New York. You know, that's about the time the Wrights came out with their Wright flyer. If it could ever achieve that kind of performance, to go from Lyon or something up to Albany or whatever it was, I forgot the article you showed me, about 1910 or something or whatever. Okay, so there it is. I guess I could say maybe not in our lifetime, but I think someday it will happen, Dick. I never say one thing about... I never am a defeatist at anything. I think anything is possible, given time and engineering and technology. So, okay, shall we look at one or two here?
Go for it, Bill.
Okay, here's one that's interesting. I was looking over. This comes from somebody also new into ham radio. And he says, I'm very confused. I see circuits, electronic circuits of the olden days, what you would call your tube technology, and the components, the way they are marked, I'm very confused because I look at schematics today and I see different markings, such as capacitors. I see things like in the old days was marked 0.01, 0.001, and all. I see the resistor markings are similar, but how come, what is TF, MMF, NF, and all these things have in common? okay, that's the difference in the markings on components that we see today. I got a good idea where they're coming from, Dick. Over.
Yeah, when my father first started studying electronics with the National Radio Institute, this was a mail order classes you could take. 1947, he started. On the GI Bill. In those days, capacitance was always measured in microfarads. That was the only unit. So when you wanted to talk about 100 picofarads of today, in those days it was called 100 microfarads. Everything was microfarads. Well, we came along and realized that we needed much bigger units. A hydrogen molecule, a helium molecule, happens to be the smallest diameter molecule there is. In meters, a helium molecule is 10 to the minus 10. In other words, you take 1 meter, add 10 zeros after it, divide it into 1. That is the approximate diameter of a helium molecule. And to write that down with 10 zeros all the time would be a pain in the tail. So a long time ago, somebody came up with a unit called angstrom. Angstrom is 10 to the minus 10 meters. Well, a lot of engineers just love things to the nearest 3 decimal places. So therefore, we've got milli, micro, nano, pico, femto, atto. Milli is 10 to the minus 3. Micro is 10 to the minus 6. Nano is 10 to the minus 9. Pico is 10 to the minus 12. Femto is 10 to the minus 15. Atto is 10 to the minus 18. So we can talk about an attometer. We can talk about a angstrom. We can talk about a tenth of a tenth of a nanometer. That happens to be 1 angstrom. So the new system of units in groups of three. The only one that's not groups of three is Angstrom, which is a group of 10. But all the others are set off in groups of three, make it very convenient. The Europeans have long time talk about nanofarad.
Repeater, time out.
The Europeans on their schematic diagrams have used nanofarads for a long period of time. 0.001 microfarad, 10 to the minus 6 farad, times 0.001 is really 10 to the minus 9. 10 to the minus 9 is 1 nanofarad. So 0.001 equals 1 nanofarad. To write down 1 NF to a European 10 years ago was a lot more convenient than writing down 0.001 microfarad, which is the way we would represent it 10 years ago. So the new system of units go all the way up to 10 to the plus 24 and down to 10 to the minus 24, which for the time being is enough. But the day will come when we talk about astronomical distances and whatever, and we need bigger numbers, and somebody's going to come up with a name for it. And some of the names right now sound a little bit strange. When it comes to bigger than one, you've got deca, hecto. Deca is 10, hecto is 100, kilo is 1,000, mega is 1,000,000, giga is 1,000,000,000, tera is 1,000,000,000,000, which is 1,000,000,000,000. So 10 to the 9 is a giga. 10 to the 12 is a tera. 10 to the 15, I've forgotten what that one was. What's the one after tera? But you can talk about gigawatts and terawatts and the 10 to the 15 watts when it comes to the total energy consumption of the world or the United States. So these units, very useful. The introductory chapters for the antenna of the reference data for radio engineers will tell you. If you look up units with the right call word in Google with Wikipedia, I'm pretty sure they define this very nicely. So it's just a matter of memorizing the names and what they mean. And they are very convenient in the modern day because there are times we have to talk about very big and very small units. My handheld calculator, my Hewlett-Packard 50 calculator, will take exponents up to 450. 10 to the 450.
Repeater, time out.
10 to the 450 or 10 to the minus 450 power is the biggest and smallest number the machine will tolerate before it overflows or underflows. Every digital-like computer has a number below which it cannot represent. That's called the underflow problem. It has a number that's real big beyond which it can't handle. That's the overflow problem. Do you really need 10 to the 450 power? And I think the answer is no. Because I remember reading an article about the biggest number that represents something close to reality. The smallest thing anyone knows is the diameter of an electron. I think it's 10 to the minus 31 meters diameter. And there isn't a word for that one. That's the smallest thing anyone knows. The biggest thing anyone knows of is the hold-on observable universe, roughly 13.7 billion light years of radius. So if you take the biggest thing you know, the hold-on universe, fill it up as tight as you can get with the smallest thing you know of, the diameter of an electron. You go through that calculation, and it's 10 to the 132 power. Electrons can be squeezed into the biggest thing we know of, the observable universe. The smallest thing we know of, packed as tight as possible, into the biggest thing we know of, you get 10 to the 132 electrons. That's 132 power. My calculator goes to 450 power. So billions and billions of universes, in theory, can be represented with the exponents of that calculator. The number is probably big enough. K2KEY, K2LAW.
This is K2KEY. Okay, let's get back to the components. I think we know where they're coming from. as Dick said, in our day of dinosaurs, of electronics, you would see a capacitor marked 0.001 microfarad, or you would see something, first of all, the way they was written, most of the type of capacitors, those were mostly a lot of them were wax covered capacitors that had an axial lead, in other words, a wire on either end. And they were marked 001 until you got down to, like, what we called MMF, micro-microfarads, or as Dick said, like we call today PF. And those capacitors in those days usually had a color code. And I'll show you how this color code is basically referenced today. If you had a 1,000 micro-microfarad capacitors in those days, 1,000, we used to call Mickey Mouse capacitor, MMF, it would have been something like, let's say, 1,000, it would have been brown, black, red. So in other words, 1, 0, and 2 zeros, and that would be 1,000 micro-microfarad. If you were to now count 6 places, that would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that would be for a 0.001 microfarad capacitor. That would have been how you would have seen it in those days. Let's take it that way first, Dick, okay?
Yes, I do remember. And the problem we had with small capacitors, which could be made out of mica, glass, and a couple of other styles, is not all of them use the exact same representation for their size. Color code was one way, but there were some other markings that were a little hard to understand at times. I wonder if you remember those, Mel. Go ahead.
Well, they have what they remember, the RETMA chart, Radio Television Manufacturers Association chart, which they give you out little cards or something. You'd be able to move the thumb with your thumb, you move it around the colors, and that would translate. There was a number of different versions of them that with colors that indicated the voltage rating of it, or what else, forgot the tolerance, or, you know, what tolerance there was. That was another factor, if you remember, Dick, over.
Yeah, and the resistive color code, black, brown, red, orange, yellow, green, violet, white, I think it's the 0 through 9. When it comes to normal resistors between, let's say, 10 ohms and 10 mega ohms, the color code works very nicely. When it comes to less than 10 ohms and fractions of an ohm, there are various variations of the color code which get a little bit complicated. So a resistor that's a fraction of an ohm with a color code representing the percentage of accuracy, that gets a little hard to read at times. I think they got silver bands and gold bands at times for accuracy. And these little bitty surface mount resistors they got nowadays, boy, some of them, there's just no way you can put a marking on them, and that represents a bit of a problem. How about you, Mel?
Roger. So, like I say, those days you would have seen, that was the way you've seen the components marked. Now you will see a lot of this stuff coming in from the Orient, and the resistors will be marked with numbers. There are still some that you will see, of course, has that standard color code, but also you see some of them, like I was looking at a board today with surface-mounted technology, and everything was marked by numbers, and the resistors even were marked, like, for instance, 102 would mean 10 and 2 zeros extra, 10 plus 2 zeros, 102 would mean 1,000 ohms, or 103 would mean 10K, or whatever, or 333 would mean 33K. Now, the stuff that comes in from Europe, as Dick was saying, could be marked as, especially the capacitors. The capacitors, say, you'll find also like 1,000 mic PF capacitor would not be marked 1,000, it would be marked 102. and if it's a capacitor, you'd know that's 1,000 CF. However, the capacitors that if you get or schematics from Europe will be marked in NF. Am I correct? Over.
Yes, and life gets a little bit more complicated when you're using higher precision resistors, which have four numbers. You may have four numbers like when you convert them, they really mean 3, 9, 1, 2. That would be 3, 9, 1, and two more zeros. In other words, they're giving you three decimal places of magnitude accuracy followed by some number of resistors. So the precision resistors get a little bit more complicated, and I'm a little bit afraid there's more than one marking system for those. Then we'll go ahead.
Okay, but let's talk about standards. You see the schematics that they have in the magazines and all. And I, in fact, one of the magazines that came through from Radio Society of Great Britain, they had the capacitors marked in NF. That was where, I guess, some of the confusion came in because of the conversion, as you say, from the stuff from the Far East that is marked in TF, and here they are marked in NF. I think that's what they meant. That's what they're alluding to, the confusion. How do you go from TF if you had, say, a 1,000 TF capacitor? What would that translate to NF? Over.
Good question. Once you know that TF is 10 to the minus 12, and NF is 10 to the minus 9, you could plug those two numbers into your handheld calculator and divide, and you'd find out there's a 1,000 to 1 ratio between them. So 1,000 TF does equal 1 NF. You move the decimal point three places. So once you know that kilo is 3, mega is 6, giga is 9, that's when you get bigger than 1. When you get smaller than 1, milli is 10 to the minus 3, micro is 10 to the minus 6, nano is 10 to the minus 9, and pico is 10 to the minus 12. Once you memorize those exponents, so to speak, converting between them is a matter of memorization and division, and it's just something you got to practice to get used to. Guarantee there's a section of Google Wikipedia which has a very nice article on this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. All right, I want to simplify this for everybody that that is involved with this. As Dick said, if we go back to the old days, let's go back to the conversion. A 0.001, what was a micro, 0.001 microfarad, if you saw it on schematic, say, of one of these old tube pieces of equipment, today would be marked possibly 1,000 and PF, or 102 PF. That's the way it would be marked today in modern times. If it came in from Europe, in other words, how did we get from 0.001 to this? We counted six places. 0.001, add three zeros after the one, so we got 1,000 TF. If we were to go now and convert this TF, and we wanted to know what it would be in NF, we go back the other way and take the 1,000 TF that we just converted to 001 to 1,000 PF, and if we go back the other way now, and we would go back three places, we would have 1 NF. So there's the derivation. The 0.001 became 1,000 PF in more modern times, or possibly 1 NF. It depends on what part of the world it's come through. How's that? Is that as simple as I think it? I think that's understandable. Over.
You've got it, Mel. Write down the number you've got starting with, and you're going to have to make yourself a little bit of a chart of what does micro and nano and pico stand for, as 10 to the minus something micro. A milli is 10 to the minus 3, micro is 10 to the minus 6, nano is 10 to the minus 9, pico is 10 to the minus 12. So those exponents, the minus numbers I just gave you, really are the number of places you've got to move the decimal place starting at unity. So if you started off with 1 farad and you want to go to 1 microfarad, you're going to move the decimal place 6 locations. And so knowing how many locations are movement between the various names tells you how far to move the decimal place on the number you've got written on the page. And so sure enough, 0.001 micro is now called 1.0 nano farads, if it's farads we're talking about. And the farad used to be an extremely big number. We almost never had a 1 farad capacitor. Now you can buy it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, yeah, I remember when, oh boy, 1 farad, you pictured a thing the size of a bathtub or whatever. You know, and today, of course, you see many applications where they have a backup memory system that is powered by, I can say, a 1 farad capacitor. I have one. I have a 1 farad 3 volt thing. It's a pretty small capacitor. I mean, 1 farad at 3 volts. Okay, now, if, like, for instance, and as Dick says, I'll go through this one more time. Let's say we had a 0.02 capacitor, 0.02 microfarad capacitor back in the old days when Dick and I were working on equipment. Today, you would most likely see that marked as a 203 PF. So if you took 203 PF, you took 20, 20, added 3 zeros, you'd have 20,000 microfarads. So that would have been what would have been back if you translated 0.02. You would see it marked today as 203. So if you take that now and was to count that backwards, this would now become, if you wanted to put it into nanofarads, you would most likely see it marked as 20 nanofarads. Am I correct, over?
You've got it, Mel. It does require some practice to be able to switch between the various units of size. But with some practice, it'll eventually make some sense. And so you got to memorize what those exponents are if you happen to be familiar with exponential mathematics. That's the way many people do it. Not everybody. Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KEY. All right. No, because I see that there is a lot of confusion, you know, because you see the difference in the circuits that are coming in from the way they're marked. And, looking at the surface-mounted technology of today, I had this eye loop on and I was looking at a board. And it's just fascinating to look at the board and see how they're able to achieve print that is so fine. But I was particularly also interested in looking at the markings on the components there. I will say that most of it, you will see it marked as numbers today, such as things like 102, 103, 201, whatever, 202, 333s, and things like that. Just remember that you most likely will be dealing with zeros. 33 and 3 zeros would make you give you a 33K resistor. The same thing would be that number system would also carry over to capacity. You have to know whether, of course, when you're looking at it, whether it's a capacitor or a resistor, because the markings, the number markings may be very similar, over.
And sometimes you can take two components that look identical, and until you put your ohmmeter across it, you may not know that one is a capacitor, one is an inductor, and one is a resistor. I've seen micro-miniature inductors, capacitors, and resistors that sometimes look awfully similar. I am curious, Mel, what is the smallest physical size of surface mount components you've worked with? I am guessing you've worked with some 805s. I'm guessing you've worked with some 0603s. Maybe you've worked with some 0402s. I'll bet you have not worked with 0201s. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, let me tell you what happened on this board. I assumed, I'm not capable, nor do I know of anyone capable of going to lift one of these integrated circuits, because you can see that the legs, the spacing between the legs, it looks like the thickness of a fly's foot or something like that, that basically fit between your legs. However, what happened here, there was nothing. The board was just not working at all, and I assumed, I said, let me make a check. I have a feeling I know maybe what happened here, and sure enough, they have these little circuit protects on the board now, I guess to keep them from frying or whatever, but, they're like, I guess they act basically as fuses, and I found, how they're marked. They're marked as 000. They're marked as circuit protects. And so this one, believe me, my finest tip on my soldering iron are just about the size of the component stick. I can't imagine how much current you can put through one of those circuit protects, but I found the open one, Dick, over.
And what did you use as a substitute component, Mel?
Another board. I took another circuit protect off the board. It's funny, I had a couple of handy talkies even that went dead, and it was the circuit protect that opened up. And I don't know really, what is a 000 circuit protect actually current rating? I mean, what can you put through them before they pop over?
Those I haven't worked with, so I don't have a good answer on those, Mel. But the smallest physical size of surface mount components you've ever worked with, I'm going to be asking you that again, if you happen to know, and anything below 0603, in my opinion, really has to be done with a stereo zoom microscope with a good lighting supply and a very small temperature-controlled soldering iron. And even then, there's quite a bit of learning skill required to do it correctly. There's a whole series of manipulating practices you've got to do with fine tweezers on these very small surface mount components. There was a question I was going to ask you on that, and all of a sudden it slipped my mind. So, I don't know the size of those. I've forgotten. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. What is the smallest? What would you say is the size of most of the components used, like, for instance, in a computer? Or if you look at some of these plug-in boards that, for instance, you will find in some of the more modern, later model, when they're still using the CRT monitors, the computer monitors, the surface mounted technology, and the TV set, what size is that? I think the TV sets and things like monitors are the little larger surface mounted components, because I guess they most likely have to have maybe a little higher current rating. Am I correct, over?
Not necessarily, no. As you build the components on a surface mount board smaller and smaller, assuming it's a low-level signal that you're handling, the advantage of the super small components is that you can pack a lot more stuff in a lot less square inches or square centimeters. You use up less real estate. And in some cases, the number of square centimeters of the printed circuit board is related to the price of the selling price of the board. So making them smaller is a strong motivation. when it comes to microprocessor boards that I've worked with, depending on the application, sometimes very inexpensive stuff has very small components. If you take a throwaway modern-day cell phone out of somebody's garbage and you take it apart, let me drop. My goodness, when you get an eye-opening. In many cases, the printed circuit board, when you look at it carefully with a high microscope magnification on the edge, you realize the printed circuit board has got 14 layers to it, even though the thing is a little bit more than a 16th of an inch thick. And it's got plated through holes on those multiple layers. And the surface mount components on the surface of the board, upper surface and lower surface, that you can see, are in many cases 04, 02s, and sometimes 02, 01s. Let me give you an example of what an 04, 02 is. If you take your set of calipers under a microscope and you look at an 04, 02 component, 04, 02 means 40 thousandths of an inch long, 20 thousandths of an inch wide. That's what 04, 02 means. 0.04 inches long, 0.02 inches wide. 40 thou inch long, 20 thou inch wide. 20 thou long, here we go. 20 thou wide, I had it right. And 40 thou long. The smallest components I've seen and sometimes used are 0201. 20 thou long, 10 thou wide. When you see a plastic bag of 0201s, you would be positive you're looking at grains of sand inside of a plastic bag. That's what it looks like. Slightly darkened grains of sand. And manipulating them under a microscope and soldering them down, that is an art form. Without quite a few hours of practice, you probably will not succeed. There's an automatic pick and place machine that assemble that board for you. Rarely are boards that size done by human hands today. But one other thing I was going to mention, I now remember what it was. If you wanted to remove one of these printed circuit surface mount microprocessor chips, the ones that really have leads coming out of the sides that bend down to the board. In theory, you could use a fancy soldering iron that's with just the right shape of the gadget you put on the end of the iron that heats up all of those 40 leads on each side simultaneously. In theory, you can do that. Almost none of us own that thing. However, we can still do it. The crude way to do it is with solder wick material. You hold the solder wick material on top of those leads, put the soldering iron on top of that. As you heat up the solder through the solder wick, the solder will suck up by capillary action 95% of all that solder. But there is another way to do it. I have on occasion with crude tools, without a high power microscope, removed a microprocessor chip that had about 20 leads per side on four sides, so there were about 80 leads there. And the way you do it is to take some stainless steel braided cable and take one strand of the stainless steel wire, slip it under all of the legs of the chip on one side, then hit each one of the legs with a soldering iron as you pull the stainless steel piece of wire forward, and you unsolder each of those legs one at a time, and the solder will not stick to the stainless steel wire. So even without solder wick, with a little bit of care, you can unsolder a 80-pin microprocessor chip off of a surface mount board with that technique. K2KEY, we've only got 3 minutes left, K2LIW.
Roger, K2KEY. Yeah, I've done that, Dick. I started to slip the little wire through and then soldered it onto a convenient spot to anchor it. on the board and then did that message of eating, pulling, and all that, that business. All right, just the final words. I just took a grain of brown rice out of the closet here, and the grain of brown rice is a little bigger than the surface-mounted circuit protect that I pulled off today. How I did it, was took it off, was with a little tiny pair of tweezers that had a rubber band, a small rubber band on it, a rubber band that they use. I have a little bag of them that they use when used that. Kids had braces on their teeth. They used these rubber bands to keep their pull, their braces tight. And one of these little rubber bands, put it onto the tweezers to hold the tweezers nowhere so they'd be closed. Then I opened and let the tweezers hang on there. I took a little, have a little piece of string going through the tweezers, which I'm holding in my mouth, and with two little tiny pinpoint soldering irons, I just heated both sides of this resistor up and then pulled my head up just slowly and lifted the component off the board, Dick, over.
Dick? Hey, you used the two soldering iron technique. Very crafty. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, one thing you didn't mention, if you have a known bad part, you can always clip the leads and very easily remove the pins and clean the pads up. But if you know you're going to be doing a lot of that stuff, I mean, you know, you could go spend $150 and buy yourself a nice little blast station. I spent $200 with all sorts of, you know, tip and gizmos and tweezers and stuff like that, because, sorry, but leaded components are becoming a thing of the past. So even if you want to build something these days, leaded components are becoming problematic. Hey, you're right. You're extremely well-equipped when it comes to soldering and desoldering equipment. I make sure that I'm very well-equipped on optical equipment like zoom microscopes, and I still haven't talked you into a zoom microscope, and you haven't talked me into a desoldering station. My, are we stuck in our ways, Eric?
Well, can I tell you, Dick, it's just when you start seeing 136 pins, I see, you know the damn thing's bad. That's a lot of pins to solder, even with a little, you know, 15-watt or 7-watt punches on it. It can be, you know, troublesome. But, by the way, the best way to put a chip back down is to line the thing up, and if you're smart, you'll have a little thing that kind of helps clamp it down, and then just glop solder all over the pins, and make sure it flows nice and don't use too much heat. And then take some solder with and clean it up and make sure you have no shorts.
Good way to go. We're about to be cut off. This was TechNet number 1241. 73 you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, back to you.
Just say goodnight. Yeah, this is the future and it's going to get, as they say, smaller. So I guess there's going to be a limit to what we can do by us humans working on it. So this is the point that we're getting at right now, coming to the end of what we can possibly do by hand. 73, we'll talk to you next week a little bit more about this, this fascinating technology. Thank you all. This is K2KEY.
The time is 12 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. 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 Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30.
UA2KLP.
Thank you.